This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission, scheduled for April 7, 2006. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good afternoon. The Federal Election Commission open meeting for Friday, April 7, 2006 will come to order. I think regardless of what happens today, we may all pledge that this will be our last Friday meeting for some time. It appears that we've been meeting quite a bit on Fridays, and maybe this can be the last time we do that. We'll have to see. First item on our agenda this afternoon, correction and approval of the minutes. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move for the consideration approval of the minutes for March 23rd, 27th, and 29th. Of 2006 as set forth in agenda document 06-22 and 06-23.
Vice Chairman, so moved. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes by a vote of 6-0. The item of business we have on today's agenda is final rules on coordinated communications. This is the ninth and final rulemaking as required by the Shays 1 litigation. And we have a couple of late submitted documents on that topic. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move for the suspension of the rules for the timely submission of documents to consider agenda documents 06-25 and 06-26.
Vice Chairman is moved. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes by a vote of 6-0. Well, the Vice Chairman and I have consulted, and I think the way we're going to proceed is we'll begin with a discussion of various approaches to the underlying regulation, the underlying rule at 109.21C4 that governs public communications, and the current rule has a demarcation turning on 120 days before an election. And the two agenda documents that we have before us have some competing approaches to treating that rule. And so we'll begin with, I'll have a few remarks on the proposal for that I'm comfortable with, and then I'll turn it over to the Vice Chairman for some comments in terms of his perspective, and then we'll begin a general discussion on that issue and see what happens. The agenda document that I issued, agenda document 0625, would basically do two things with respect to the underlying rule. First, it would shorten the time frame for House and Senate elections from the current 120 days to 60 days before any primary or any general election. And I won't go into great detail about all the data that we collected, because it's quite a bit. But I'll just briefly touch on why I think that the empirical evidence that we have before us overwhelmingly supports a 60-day time frame for Congress. And I'll be referring just briefly to the charts that from the CMAG company that we released when we opened up the comment period for supplemental comments on the data sets. And first, focusing on the general elections for Senate and House, the data sets that we received, starting with chart S3, which is the total number of media spots airing on or before a Senate general election, indicate that 94.73% of those spots aired within 60 days of a general election. And then focusing on chart S4, which is the next one in the compilation, that shows that within 60 days of the general election, 97.20% of the total cost of media spots would be covered under a 60-day rule. The House data is similar. Chart H3 shows that within 60 days of the general election, 98.09% of the total number of media spots would be covered under a 60-day rule. And chart H4 shows that within 60 days of the general election, 98.75% of the total cost of media spots would be covered. In looking at this data in aggregate for House and Senate general elections, approximately 96% of the total number of media spots would be covered, and approximately 98% of the total cost of media spots would be covered. Now, the Circuit Court made clear in reversing Judge Kohler-Catelli that the court made clear as a matter of law that the FEC could have a content standard for coordinated communications. And the Circuit Court further held that proximity to an election is a relevant standard and a permissible standard for the agency to adopt. In terms of how much of election-influencing activity needed to be covered within any such time standard, the court also made clear that the governing standard is a substantiality test. And more importantly, it made clear that 100% coverage is neither required nor appropriate, in terms of what that standard ought to be. Now, as courts are wont to do, they didn't provide specific criteria about what substantiality means, but that is the governing standard in the circuit court opinion. And I feel very comfortable that with figures in the 96 to 98% range for House and Senate general election activity, we are well within any type of plausible substantiality argument. I think the data is of a similar nature in terms of House and Senate primaries. Turning briefly back to the chart, chart S1 shows that within 60 days of a primary for the Senate, 91.60% of the total number of media spots would be covered under a 60-day rule. Chart S2 shows that within 60 days of a primary, 93.32% of the total cost of media spots would be covered. And aggregating the various primary data for House and Senate, approximately 90% of the total number of media spots would be covered under a 60-day rule, and approximately 93% of the total cost of media spots would be covered. So I think there's very strong empirical evidence on two points. One, that the current 120-day rule for House and Senate, if anything, is overly broad. And two, that a 60-day standard would meet any substantiality test as set out by the circuit court. And for those reasons, I advocate that the commission adopt a 60-day time frame for House and Senate elections in terms of 109.21(c)(4). Turning briefly to the presidential side of the equation, the agenda document I put out advocates that we retain the current 120-day rule for president. And just real briefly, a couple things I think are important to note, and charts P9 and P10 I think are the most pertinent. First, under current law, there is a 120-day nationwide coverage from the start of the general election. The general election in 2004 was November 2nd, so this nationwide coverage began in the early part of July. And second, equally important, there is also a 120-nationwide window before each party's national conventions. So it's not just one 120-day window with respect to the general election. In many respects, it's two 120-day windows, although there is some overlap depending upon when the parties hold their conventions. So turning to chart P9, which sets out the number of media spots aired on or before the general election in within fully media markets that are fully contained within a single battleground state, looking at that data and plotting out the windows, day 120 to the election day is the first demarcation, and that, and all the activity that is covered there, all the advertising that would be covered there under our current rule of 120 days. But then equally important, the Democratic National Convention was held from July 26th to July 29th. And on the chart P9, that's referenced as day 99 before the general election. There's a 120-day nationwide window that comes off of that date. So that essentially the current 120-day rule covers 206 days before the general election in terms of the Democratic Convention. 206 days across the country covered entirely, meaning that in the 2004 cycle, that began on March 28th and extended all the way to the November election date, no exceptions, no exclusions. Similarly, on the Republican side, there was a 120-day window before the Republican Convention, which yielded 181 days, just a little bit more than 6 months before the general election is totally covered. And in terms of the percentage of total ads that are covered under existing law, the data indicates that approximately 93.64% of the total media spots are covered under the Democratic window, which opens on March 28th through Election Day. Again, the circuit court has not been crystal clear about what a substantiality test involves, but in my view, when you're in the 93, 94, 96% range, I feel comfortable that that meets a substantiality test as set out by the circuit court. The primary data, also reflected on chart P7 for president, shows that 91.56% of the total number of media spots run before a primary or caucus are covered under current law. And chart P8 indicates that 95.11% of the total cost of media spots run before a primary convention are covered under current law. So I feel very comfortable overall that current law adequately addresses the governing legal standard in this area. But I want to make two final points. First, there's no question that whatever, if we're going to have a content standard and if we're going to have a time dimension, there will be outliers. There will be outliers no matter where we set that mark. For example, Howard Dean began running ads in Iowa in the summer of 2003. Now, a lot of people question what on earth he was doing that, and I guess he found out when the Iowa caucus results came in. But he was running those ads in the summer of 2003. Now, I don't think it would be appropriate, given that that was an outlier and a very small fraction of the advertising spending at issue, to have a time window that started in the summer of 2003, even though a candidate did choose to run those ads. So I think the first point that I want to emphasize is reasonable people can disagree about what a substantiality test involves, and, you know, does it mean that we have to cover 95% of the activity, 93% of the activity, 98% of the activity? I feel like if we're in the 90s, we're in good shape. But I think a corollary of that is that there will always be outliers, and if there's 3% or 5% or 9% occurring in the off year or well before the general election, but that's exactly what it is. It is not the locus of activity. It is not the period of time that candidates have chosen through their, and they know best in terms of when voters are most influenced. It is not the period of time in which election-influencing ads are airing. And it is often the period of time where other types of ads are airing, including grassroots lobbying activities and other types of advocacy to federal candidates and office holders. And for that reason, I think it's fully appropriate for us to adhere to our current 120-day rule for president and move to a 60-day rule for Congress. And with that, I think I will turn it over to the Vice Chairman for comments on behalf of his approach. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're here to reconsider our regulations regarding coordination because the Shays Court found that the Commission had not justified the third part of the content prong of our test. That prong covers public communications that feature clearly identified candidates for federal office that are distributed within 120 days of a primary or general election and that are directed at voters in the featured candidate's jurisdiction. We have returned in part to consider whether a temporal timeline that we drew reasonably defined the period when non-express advocacy speech relating to an election occurs or whether the speech instead relates to the election itself, and also to consider the risk that the line we draw creates the potential for evasion limitations on the prohibitions on contributions and expenditures in FECA. And we held a public hearing and received comments from 28 different groups and subsequently a hearing where 18 people testified. And in the process of collecting all of that data, one of the things we specifically asked for and sought out was empirical data that would help guide us in trying to decide how we draw these lines. The closest we got to receiving any kind of empirical data was one set of joint comments that submitted specific examples of speech, either by candidates or by groups, that they interpreted we could reasonably define a motive in that speech that was electoral. And they produced these examples for speech that occurred outside of the 120-day time period. We were unable to get a sense of the relationship of these particular examples to the overall amount of spending that was occurring during these time periods. And as a consequence, despite the tight budget here at the agency, we went out and bought some data from TNS Media Intelligence, which used to be known as CMAG, regarding when candidates spent money on TV ads. Broadcast advertisements on television. And our staff here tried to work with that data so that we could have a good idea of when money was being spent by candidates in particular states. And I want to take a moment just to thank and acknowledge our staff here, both our IT staff led by Alec Palmer and the lawyers in OGC who in this project were led by Brad Deutsch, who spent an enormous amount of time trying to work with this data and present it in a form that allowed us to draw meaningful conclusions from it. And I think they succeeded. I think that what we found from that is that spending in House and Senate races, both the general and the primary elections, overwhelmingly occurred in the two-month time period right before the election. And those numbers, depending upon whether you're looking at which side of the Hill or the primaries of the general, range roughly from 88% to 98% of the spending that the candidates did occurred within that two-month time frame. If you look at the four-month time frame that our current rule encompasses, it really captured at least 99% of the spending by candidates. And this corresponded generally with the testimony that we'd heard from the witnesses and the comments that we'd received from parties and candidates on how spending is done. as well as with other records that are routinely submitted to the FEC by political committees about when their spending occurred. The presidential spending was more spread out throughout the year, in part due to there being a range of different primary dates, in part because presidential campaigns have greater resources and probably other factors as well that weren't as easy to discern. And the thing that is different in the presidential races as opposed to House and Senate is twofold. One is the 120-day trigger that we have in the current rule applies both to the general election and the party conventions, and then there are also multiple primary dates. The consequence of the 120-day rule applying both the convention and the general election was that, as the chairman noted, the 120-day rule in effect applied in the last presidential cycle for about 184 days for the Republicans and about 219 days for the Democrats. And we were very aware as we thought through that this is going to change, that whether there are gaps between the end of the primaries and the beginning of the 120-day period related to the convention, or whether there's a gap between the convention time period and the 120 days for the general, could shift depending a little bit on when the parties chose to have their conventions. The consequence of this in this particular election cycle was that there was a gap between the ending of the primary season for both parties and the beginning of the 120-day time period related to the convention, although there was no gap between the end of the convention and the beginning of the 120 days that related to the general election. As we looked at money that was spent in these gap periods, we found really no statistically significant spending in the House or the Senate races. However, the presidential races were a different question. And I've put up on the sidewall there a chart that provides a little detail. Because as we began to look at the spending in the gap between the end of the primaries and the beginning of the convention period, we found in the presidential race what I think was a significant amount of spending. And it was more pronounced in the Republican Party than in the Democratic Party, I think largely because of the timing of the conventions of the two parties and the fact that in one party there were contested primaries and in the other party there were not. I don't think there was anything particular about them being Republicans or Democrats that created this effect. But if you look at the spending in the gaps in the Republican primary, overall about 14% of spending falls within the gaps. And that gap spending becomes even more pronounced in the battleground states. The staff broke these out somewhat by media markets, but about 38% of the spending in the Seattle media market occurs in that gap period, which is not covered by our current 120-day rule. In Wisconsin, about 20% of the spending occurs within that gap period. About 15% of Republican Party candidate spending occurs in Ohio during the gap, and in Florida it ran between sort of 12 and 15% depending upon which of the various media markets you look at. And so the numbers that we saw simply from candidate spending varied a great deal between the House and the Senate candidates, where the spending really spiked in the last 2 months, and the presidential spending, which as you look at the charts the chairman referred to, is spread out more evenly throughout the year. And as you look at spending within the gaps, it appears that there is an actuality, for a potential in the future of there being significant amounts of spending in the gaps. The conclusion that I reach and the proposal that I'm going to support today does the following as a consequence. It retains the current 120-day rule for both the House, the Senate, and the presidential campaigns. I do not agree that we should shrink down the time period in the House and the Senate to 60 days for a couple of reasons. One is because I think the data that we purchased from CMAG tells only part of the story. It only addresses spending by the candidates themselves. We did not look at party spending. We do not have data on outside group spending for a range of reasons. I mean, the cost of collecting the data, the quality of the data screens that were available to us made those harder to get, less valuable to get, and we didn't. But we do have, I do have much less confidence that relying exclusively on that data gives us a clear answer as to how the spending occurs. In addition, one of the questions the court asked us to consider was whether there was a risk the groups would move outside of whatever temporal time window we created and begin spending outside of there. I think that risk is far greater with a 60-day window when spending on the 70th day would presumably have much greater significance than sticking with the current 120-day time period, which, if the data reflecting that the overwhelming amount of spending is occurring in the last 60 days, any spending outside of that 120-day time window would be dramatically less valuable. The second conclusion that I draw from this is that we need to close the gap in presidential races. While I think there is really little or no evidence that there is a significant amount of spending in House or in the gap period in House and Senate races, I think that there is evidence of that occurring in the presidential races. And I think that chart reflects that. And so those just briefly are the considerations that have gone in to my support for the proposal that I will vote for today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. I think even though we have competing views on this issue, I really do admire your chart. I think it's outstanding. I'm told that we're having some technical difficulties with our microphone system, so we'll need to just briefly shut them off, and then we will put them back on. So why don't we go ahead and do that, and we can then carry on from there. Thank you, Madam Secretary. Okay, our mics are back up and running, so we'll proceed from here. All right, why don't we open the floor and have a general discussion of the competing approaches to the underlying rule at 10921C4. Discussion. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to say a few words in support of the proposal that the Vice Chairman, Commissioner Walther, and I have put forward. I think the Vice Chairman made the case, and it's a good one. I'm persuaded by what he said. But I just want to add a couple of thoughts. Since we're talking about coordinated communications, my guiding principles for amending the coordinated communications rule are threefold, and I'll stick with the alliterative theme. My goals are compliance, consistency, and clarity. I think in the first instance we need to comply with the statute, we need to comply with the guidance from the circuit court, get into more C words, and we need to promote compliance with whatever rule we come up with. The rule that we adopt should be one that the regulated community can understand and can work with and will be able to comply with. And in part because of that criteria, I'm also looking at a rule that will be consistent. If I were writing on a blank slate, I'm not sure that I would have devised a rule that involves a three-part test, and then two of the three parts have four or five subparts to them. It's a little bit complicated. But that is the rule that was adopted in 2002, and the regulated community learned it and seems to have understand it at this point. And we've had a variety of coordination rules over the years, and I think that to start from scratch now would not be advisable. It wouldn't be in the best interest of anybody, because we do want people to comply with whatever we come up with, and if we keep changing the ground rules on them dramatically, it just makes it very difficult. So I started out with the objective of trying to work within the framework that was set up in 2002 and improve on it, but not make dramatic changes in how it was organized. And the final criterion that I'm looking at is clarity. And again, if we want compliance, then we need to be clear about what we're saying. We need to write the rules in words that are easy to understand, and we need to not use terms that are going to confuse the issue and have people place people in a situation where they feel like they have to submit an advisory opinion every day in order to figure out what they're supposed to do to comply with the rules. I think when you look at the data, and I think it's great data as far as it goes, on closing the gap on the presidential side, it is very compelling. And not only do we have good data on this, but I think it also comports with common sense. This is, I think, why the court asked the question, should we have different standards for the House and Senate races and for the presidential? Because I think anybody who's lived through a presidential election cycle knows that it does start earlier than most House and Senate races do. People do start their action earlier. And I think there is no better evidence that people are doing advertising in advance of 120 days on the presidential side than looking at what happened in the last election. The president spent, I don't remember the exact number, something on the order of $250 million during the primaries. Well, he was uncontested during the primaries. So it's just not plausible that he spent $250 million to win an uncontested nomination. He spent that money during the primaries because he was looking towards the general. And that's what that money, $250 million worth, was spent for. And well spent, apparently, because at the end of the day, he won. So I think that was a shrewd decision on his part to spend that money and to spend it early, but it was well outside of the 120-day window for the general election, and yet that was the election that it was intended to influence. And I think that, you know, that, as I said, it comports with what people understand from living through the process, it comports with the data that we've raised, and I think it comports with what the court was, where the court was trying to lead us in its decision. And I also think that when you look at the data on the House and Senate windows, it's certainly indisputable that most candidates spend most of their advertising dollars as close to the election as possible. That's when they think it will have the most impact. Nobody's going to argue with that as a proposition. But if we cut back from 120 to 60 days on the congressional races, House and Senate, we're not leaving any buffer zone. And I think that it would, lead people to just bump their spending over the line to 61 days or 62 days and still have a fair impact on the election. But I also think it wouldn't survive court scrutiny. And as I said in the last rulemaking, or was it the one before? I can't remember. One of my goals in all of these rulemakings is to win the next time, should there be a next time, that we have to go to court and defend these regulations. And I think if we cut that window down to 60 days from 120 days, given the court's expressed skepticism about the 120 days, we lose when we go to court. That's my view, and that's why I won't vote for it, because I'm not going to vote for anything that I think is going to be a loser in court. I think with 120 days, with the data that we've collected, I think we can support that for the congressional races, and I feel comfortable with that. So if we could keep the time limit at 120 days for the House and Senate races and fill in the gap on the presidential races, start at 120 days out from the primary and then just keep going until the general, I think that we will have gone a long way towards supporting what we're doing. We'll have a very defensible position. I think we can win in court on it, and I think it makes sense. And we will have complied, we will be consistent, and we will be clear. And those are my goals. So that's why I support that proposal. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub. Other discussion on the underlying rule and the competing approaches? Commissioner Mason.
Well, excuse me. I'm a little puzzled about the House and Senate numbers. The Vice Chairman, Commissioner Weintraub, both indicated some concern about circumvention. And I understand that, and I think the problem I see is that right now, in fact, and it was rather surprised to me, having voted for 60 days 2 years ago, didn't get it then, but having looked at the statute and thinking the closest statutory fit was indeed the electioneering communications provision, I take it that the people who had crafted that actually had some data or some knowledge behind it, and that turned out to be the sweet spot. And so if we want a buffer zone, we can certainly have a buffer zone that's less than twice the period that we would otherwise need to cover. In other words, if we're worried about day 61 or something like that, well, you know, we can go out some period of time other than an additional 60 days. So, that's the first point I'd make about the House and Senate. I note that at 90 days, we get to 99% coverage of ads for Senate general elections, Senate primaries, and House general elections, which I think, as the chairman points out, would meet any one substantiality test, and I think it's somewhere in the mid-90s in terms of House primaries. My suspicion about the House primaries is that those outlier ads are self-funded challenger candidates, and which, curiously enough, would be exactly the candidates who don't need coordinated spending because they're writing their own checks. That we could probe into that if we were seriously interested. So the other problem or query I've got about the data are as to some of the criticisms of it, because it seemed to me one of the things the court was asking is, particularly the district court, that I think some of us are most worried about, because we feel like we've got a skeptical judge, is, well, what time did the candidates do this? And the point behind that is, at what point are these ads valuable to the candidates? And so I think the data that we have is very well fit to answer that question, because it says when the candidates are running the ads. When outside organizations are running the ads may not have a particularly close relationship to influencing the election, because one of the things we know is that there are can be several different factors as to why outside groups run ads. Some of the ads that people will point to as ones that they're somehow interested in are what we would look at and call lobbying ads or mixed-purpose ads. In other words, they evidently are calling on people to do things, and we can make some judgment, some argument about, well, it's a phony issue ad, or it really is or really isn't, but the point is it's not candidate ads. And so I think those aren't particularly relevant to answering the question, at what time is an ad valuable to the candidate, and therefore at what time is there a potential corruptive influence by allowing someone else to pay for that ad on behalf of the candidate? And the answer seems to be, for House and Senate candidates, once you get more than a couple of months out, the value presumably gets to be pretty low. There are a number of things about actually both rules that I would do differently, and I may want to offer amendments regarding at some point. But as for myself, if we're willing to follow the data, then I think we ought to be willing to follow it both ways. And I would be willing to vote for a rule that closed the presidential gap to get us to something in the high 90s if we also adjusted the House and Senate rule in a similar way. And while I think we could support 60 days, I think for the anti-circumvention reasons that some of my colleagues brought up, I think 90 days would be reasonable and would get us to a point at that 99% point that I think even a skeptical judge would have a hard time arguing didn't cover enough of the ads at issue.
Thank you, Commissioner Mason. Further discussion on the underlying rule and the issues we have here?
Just in the interest of brevity, I apologize. I thought you were looking my way. I just started without
the floor is yours.
echo the comments of Commissioners Lenhard and Weintraub on this. I think the empirical data is very important to me in breaking through the conceptually foreclosing the gap. I can see the reasonable arguments on both sides on the House and Senate. I think the better rule is to stick with the one we have, because for the reasons that Commissioner Weintraub mentioned, simply that this is not the total ball game, and other spending has to be trailing fairly closely in there, and maybe even in some cases picking up first. And likewise, this is the most easily modifiable conduct too, because you're still fairly close to the election, and it might just push back some spending more so than with respect to the presidential race. So those are my reasons for supporting the rule that we've endorsed.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
All right, I guess I get to play roundup right here. We're kind of down into the details where we're discussing this regulation, but I think it's very important to keep in mind an overarching policy objective. And, you know, we're issuing a regulation here that directly affects and intrudes into political speech, which is the most basic right we have protected by the First Amendment. You know, my belief is that when you've got that kind of a basic constitutional right at stake, our regulation has to be drawn as narrowly as possible so that on the one hand we are implementing the statute as intended, but on the other we're not placing impermissible burdens on political speech. I think, Mr. Chairman, that your approach does that. And while there's been some talk here of consistency, you know, I don't think it's consistent to rely on the data we have here on the presidential gap, but not rely on the data for reducing the congressional time period down to 60 days. That will cover in the mid-90s percent of all the ads that are put out, and the idea of having a buffer zone after that, well, you know, the First Amendment doesn't have a buffer zone, and I don't think we can put one into our regulations. The other thing I would mention, again, and this is on a very small percentage of ads that are outside of these time periods we're proposing, 120 for presidential, 60 for congressional, is that I've been working on voting issues now for many years, and all the data I've seen, all the social studies I've seen on voting and when people go to vote, is that voters do not pay attention until very shortly before an election. And money spent on ads far out from the election is basically money wasted that doesn't affect the election. And if it doesn't affect the election, and it's a very small percentage, I really don't see why we should be concerned with it. So, Mr. Chairman, I want to support your regulation.
Thank you, Commissioner Moskowski. Two quick points. I do agree with what's been said here about narrow tailoring, because there's no question that what we do here does affect fundamental rights in terms of free expression. And Commissioner Weintraub, I think, rightly identified litigation risks as something that we should focus on, and I think that's right. And her view being that going down to 60 days for Congress could increase our litigation risk. But I take the same approach with retaining 120 days for Congress, because if a 60-day, or as Commissioner Mason is outlining, perhaps a 90-day time window covers, you know, 93, 95, 98% of the relevant candidate spending, the 120-day rule is overbroad. Is broader than what is necessary to effectuate the statute and imposes restrictions beyond what is necessary for the agency to implement the law. And so I have an equal concern litigation-wise in terms of the regulation being challenged as overly broad. But I agree that litigation risks are something that we need to appropriately weigh. The other comment I have is that there's no question there's no perfect data sets. And I do want to echo the Vice Chairman's words, thanking everybody on the IT staff and also in the Office of General Counsel and also the outside vendor who worked to put these data sets together. I think it was a remarkable effort under very stressful circumstances in a really compressed time frame. And I share your strong thanks for that effort. But no data set is perfect. There's no doubt about it. We have, I think, that being said, a really compelling record in terms of when candidate spending takes place, which by definition is campaign-related. But on top of the data sets that we have the vast body of evidence that Congress collected in passing BCRA. The vast body of evidence that Congress looked at in deciding to implement the electioneering communications rules, the vast majority of evidence that was collected by experts and others that basically said that in terms of outside spending by interest groups or party committees, the tremendous locus of activity is in the last 60 days before a general election, the last 30 days before a primary. And the plaintiffs who challenged the constitutionality of the electioneering communications rule did not take issue with that vast majority of evidence. They did not take issue with the fact that post-Labor Day is really the focal point for advertising. They challenged it on other grounds, that it was overly broad, overly broad because it covered all types of activity, any type of ad that depicted a candidate, regardless of any other content in the ad. I think that the data sets we have before us are very compelling and very strong. I do agree that they're not perfect and there are limitations to the data, but we do also have the data sets and can take essentially judicial notice or agency notice of the factual record that was compiled in the McConnell litigation and was compiled by Congress in enacting BCRA. That did include data sets for outside interest groups and party committees and did conclude that the vast majority of election-influencing activity occurred within the last 60 days before a general election. So those are just my two comments on those points. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you. I'd like to address the question of consistency in the use of the data, and I think we are being consistent because I think the data is going to different questions. I mean, at its core, what we're trying to discern is in what time period election-related speech is occurring, because presumably the coordination of that speech is of value to the candidate. And I think what the data set and the chart up there around presidential spending in the gap period shows us is that there is a significant amount of spending occurring in that time period. And so to the degree that we don't close the gap, this reflects that we have not, that there is a significant amount of spending that hasn't been captured. I think the question of whether what the data set shows about how candidates spend, within the 60-day time period or the 120-day time period is different because there is many other different kinds of spending that is going on that data doesn't even begin to try and capture. I think that there is we have far less clarity, it's far more difficult for me to believe that we would rely entirely upon the data related to candidate spending to draw conclusions about the broader question of when election-related speech is occurring.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Commissioner Mason.
I just want to probe that. But that's precisely the data you were relying on in coming to a conclusion about the gap.
Yes, in the gap, it's showing that spending is occurring. It doesn't prove the opposite. The question of it is, does that show all the spending? Or is there significant spending that isn't captured by that particular kind of political actor?
If our task is to prove a negative or to prove out on some other survey, then let's go back. I didn't oppose going out and getting this data, but I was not the one urging us to do it, and I was skeptical about the utility of it, and it turned out to be more enlightening than I thought it might be, but I find it extremely frustrating if I'm told, well, having gone out and asked for this data, and that we can't draw a conclusion from it because we didn't ask for enough, we didn't ask for the right stuff. I mean, I understand the proposition that, well, if we find something, that's enough to go on, but if we find nothing, oh, that doesn't prove anything. I don't think that's a particularly useful way to do business. And I think, as I said, I think, in fact, this does show what candidates are spending their money on, and I've explained why I think what other people are spending their money on is less relevant. But if the impetus is we need more data, then let's go back and get it, I suppose.
Mr. Vice Chairman. I guess my response is that I think in part the data is useful because it proved what you sensed at the beginning to be true, which is that the overwhelming majority of spending by candidates occurs within the 60-day time period right before the election. I think what it doesn't show to me is that we have a record that would justify setting the time frame at that 60-day limit.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to try. I'm not saying when this will persuade anybody, but I just want to try phrasing it a slightly different way because it's persuasive to me. We went out and got the data that the court actually asked us to get. They asked whether congressional, senatorial, and presidential races occur on the same cycle. They asked when do candidates in fact limit campaign-related advocacy to the 4 months surrounding elections, or does substantial election-related communication occur outside that window? So we focused on the questions that the court asked. I think the data is valuable, but we knew going out the door that what we were going to get was going to be, in some sense, incomplete. Now, if an incomplete data set shows you that even incomplete as it is, there's a whole lot of spending going on in the presidential gap periods, it seems to me that I don't need more evidence to fill in the gap than I've already got. There may be more spending going on in those gap periods than I know about, but even the stuff that I know about based on the data that we've collected convinces me. So the numbers aren't going to go down in the presidential gap periods. They're only going to go up if we collected more data. But the fact that incomplete data indicates that most of the spending is going on within 60 days is not necessarily an argument to shrink it to that precise time window, which I think gives us no argument on anti-circumvention, which is a consideration that the courts on up to the Supreme Court have taken very seriously. And I want to also briefly address the argument that the chairman made about the wealth of data that was collected during the drafting of BCRA and during the McConnell litigation on the spending that goes on during the EC windows. That's all true, but it only goes so far, because based on that wealth of data, Congress wrote a law in which they said part of what we want you to take into account when you draft your new coordinated communication rule — it's too bad they didn't give us a little bit more guidance than they did, but that's what they gave us — is electioneering communications. We absolutely want you to focus on that as that content and that time window. But they didn't say stop there. They said that's only part of it. Now go out and draft a rule that's going to take into account electioneering communications as well as other factors. And they listed some of them for us. So I think that restricting it to the electioneering communication window would actually not comport with the statute. It doesn't seem to be what Congress had in mind when they drafted it. They surely could have done that if they wanted to. They could have said, boy, we love this 60-day window so much, we're going to apply it to coordinated communications and everything else. But they didn't. They said, yes, include electioneering communications in your coordinated communication provision, but go beyond that. And that's what I think we're trying to do.
I think a couple quick points. First, I do really admire your chart, Mr. Vice Chairman. I've noted that before. I think it may be a first in the annals of the Federal Election Commission, but I doubt it will be the last time such a blow-up chart is presented. I feel like we're on the House floor or something like that. Although I think we're far more civilized than, maybe that's not a high standard, but far more civilized than the House of Representatives. Two quick points. First, even taking into account this gap situation, as charts P9 indicate and P10, when you look at what is covered under current law on the Democratic side, over 93% of the total media spots are covered. And that's because the windows of coverage under existing law begins in late March and goes all the way through the general election with absolutely no gap. Across the country, no exceptions. And I feel very comfortable that a range of 93-94% meets a substantiality test as set out by the circuit court. And the story is similar with respect to primaries. As chart P7 indicates, 91.56% of the total number of media spots run before the presidential primaries are captured under the current 120-day chart. And in terms of the total cost of the media spots, chart P8, 95.11% of the total primary ads are covered under current law. So again, we're seeing data in a lot of these areas in the low to mid-90s. And I feel comfortable that meets the substantiality test and is narrowly tailored to implement the statute. And the second point I'd make is that there definitely are going to be outliers. As I noted earlier, Howard Dean began advertising in the summer of 2003, and that's reflected, I think, as a microscopic little bump at day, below day 330 or something like that. But I don't think it'd be appropriate to fashion a time window around that spending because it is an outlier. And I think that the key focus ought to be, where is the bulk of the spending occurring? Where is the vast majority of election-influencing activities occurring? And under current law, I think we do a very solid job of covering that for president. And for Congress, I think under the current 120-day rule, we have an overly broad regime that I think gives me a lot of difficulty. And we have compelling data that provides a vehicle for us to make a mid-course correction on that score and line our regulations up with the empirical data we have in hand. That still would allow us to cover in the low to mid-90s in terms of election-influencing ads for the House and Senate, which I think fully meets the substantiality test as the Circuit Court has set out and is not an overly broad standard in that regard. Other discussion on these issues. Would we like to begin voting? Would a colleague like to offer a motion? Since I'm barred from offering a motion, would anyone else like to offer a motion, and we can begin on that? I think it's been a good discussion. It's illuminated a lot of issues, and I think if people are prepared to begin voting, we can do that. Or if there are other further comments on these issues. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move that we accept and approve Agenda Document 06-25, which is the regulation that you have presented to the Commission.
How about, would we like to just focus on the provision that relates to 109.21C4?
I will take that as a friendly amendment to the motion, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Although I'm happy if people want to adopt the overall document. Boy, it would be a really great weekend then. All right, Commissioner Von Spakovsky has moved approval of that portion of agenda document number 0625 that pertains to proposed amendments to the regulation at 109.21C4, which basically would establish a 60-day time frame for the House and Senate and 120 days for President. Discussion on Commissioner Von Spakovsky's motion. Hearing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor say aye. Aye. All opposed?
No.
No.
Motion fails in a vote of 3-3. Commissioner Von Spakovsky, Mason, and Toner voting affirmatively. The Vice Chairman, Commissioner Weintraub, and Commissioner Walther voting no. Further motions on 109.21. Mr. Vice Chairman.
I'm going to move for the adoption of the portion of Agenda Document 06-26 that relates to amending 109.21C4.
Vice Chairman has moved for adoption of that portion of Agenda Document 0626 that relates to 109.21C4, which would maintain the 120-day rule for the House and Senate, but slightly broaden in some respects the presidential window as set forth in the document. Discussion on the Vice Chairman's motion. Commissioner Mason.
Two things. One is, as I briefly alluded to before, if we were to adopt this, I would want to reserve the right to come back and revisit some issues that we haven't really discussed thus far, in particular precisely what the content standard would be. But I would like to offer an amendment to the Vice Chairman's amendment on page 2, line 20, to strike out 120 days and insert 90 days. And that would relate to the time period for the House and Senate candidates.
Commissioner Mason has offered a substitute to the Vice Chairman's motion that would modify the Vice Chairman's proposal related to 109.21C4 to modify the House and Senate time window from 120 days to 90 days. All right, let's start with debate on Commissioner Mason's substitute motion. Commissioner Mason.
One of the gulfs I see between between my colleagues and myself is that some of us are at least equally concerned with regulating too much is too little. And that's why when I look at this data and I see no support in there for getting out for these extended time periods, and then I'm told, well, maybe there's some other reason that we don't have before us, but we think something might be out there. I don't think that is an acceptable reason for regulating or for picking particular dates. I think it is equally bad to regulate too much as to regulate too little. I understand the circumvention rationale. That's what the judge asked about. And I understand the point that, well, if this is concentrated in 60 days and we pick just 60 days, that that, you know, the issue of going out to 61 or 62 becomes live. At 90 days, as I mentioned before, we get 99% of the ads, and for someone to change their behavior, they'd have to change it a lot. They'd have to go out from where now most of this activity is concentrated in a 60-day period to 30 days before that. I think that ought to be enough to take care of any circumvention concerns. Just lastly, on the reviewability, because that came up in terms of other reasons, I wouldn't put it past anyone, but it's going to be a little difficult to go back into the court and having gathered this data on candidate spending, then be told, oh, well, I didn't mean you had to get data on candidate spending. I meant you had to get data on spending by other groups. And I suppose we could go back and do that, but that's a risk I'm willing to run, because I do think we made a good faith effort to do what the judge told us to do, and I think we would have an eminently supportable, defensible rule at 90 days.
Thank you, Commissioner Mason. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to ask Commissioner Mason if he's willing to hold off on what I understand to be a compromise effort on his part, and I appreciate that, because I, just as you guys had a clean up or down vote on your proposal, I'd like to have a clean up or down vote on our proposal.
I don't object to that. My principle. That's fine.
You don't object to that?
Okay. I will withdraw my amendment.
Okay, so then we are now going to return to the vice chairman's motion to adopt. Is there further discussion on the vice chairman's motion to maintain the 120-day rule for Congress and then make the alterations he has outlined to the presidential rule? Any further discussion on that? Hearing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? No. Motion fails by a vote of 3-3. The vice chairman, Commissioner Weintraub and Walther voting affirmatively, Commissioners Toner, Mason, and Von Spakovsky voting no. Commissioner Mason, a motion to substitute.
I would offer a motion to adopt the C4 alternative as put forth by the vice chairman, except that the time period for House and Senate candidates would be 90 days.
Commissioner Mason has moved to adopt amendments to current Rule 109.21(c)(4) as outlined in the Vice Chairman's agenda document, with the exception that the relevant time frame for House and Senate candidates would be 90 days as opposed to 120 days. Debate on Commissioner Mason's motion. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to propose we take a brief recess.
That is always in order. With that, we will take a five-minute recess. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Mason's motion to adopt a 90-day time frame for House and Senate candidates and fill in the gap on the presidential side as outlined by the vice chairman's and Commissioner Walther and Weintraub's agenda document 0626. Further debate on Commissioner Mason's motion. Hearing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion passes by a vote of 6-0, and I must say that is very good news.
I love those 6-0 votes.
Okay, so that regulation is adopted. Commissioner Mason, I understand you may have a second order amendment or any further consideration of 109.21.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, we're probably at a later point going to get to the issue of some solicitation rules and endorsement rules, which is in both of the versions that are before us, I think are premised on a promote, support, attack, pose standard. And it strikes me that rather than having a rule that covers everything and then a couple of exemptions that let some things out, that it might be better simply to use the promote, support, attack, oppose standard throughout. I think it would be useful because it would allow endorsements and solicitations rather broadly. It would make for Commissioner Weintraub referred to the rather complex nature of the rule, which I fully concede, and I don't want to make it more complex. And by having this, you know, complex rule and then having a couple of exceptions to it, I think we do that. And so I think the best way to handle those issues would be in the three paragraphs where it says a public communication refers to a political party, to insert right at that point, or refers to a clearly identified candidate, or refers to presidential candidate, as the case may be, to insert and promotes, supports, attacks, or opposes that party or another candidate or an opposing party. So, I mean, we can, if my colleagues are comfortable at least discussing that concept, I can put it as a motion, and I'm sure we can work out what precisely the language would be, but my proposal would be to support, or to, excuse me, to insert, promote, support, attack, and oppose at the appropriate place in each of those three paragraphs.
Okay, discussion on, and I think it's good that let's have a discussion before we style it as a motion, and we'll figure out, for motion purposes, if one's offered, where exactly we put the language. But let's have a general discussion on Commissioner Mason's concept. Commissioner Mosikowski.
I would just like to say I certainly support this, and I'd like to, if I can, give a quick quote from the K court decision, which I think supports, in fact, this very thing, and that is, the court noted that when Congress repealed the former coordination rule, it, quote, studiously avoided prescribing any specific standard. Furthermore, quote, insofar as such statements may relate to political or legislative goals independent from any electoral race, goals like influencing legislators' votes or increasing public awareness, we cannot conclude that Congress unambiguously intended to count them as expenditures and thus as contributions when coordinated. To the contrary, giving appropriate Chevron deference, we think the FEC should construe the expenditure definition's purposive language as leaving space for collaboration between politicians and outsiders on legislative and political issues involving only a weak nexus to any electoral campaign, close quote. And I think that very much supports having a PASO standard. Thank you.
Additional discussion on the conceptual approach outlined by Commissioner Mace. All right, Commissioner, your sense of where you would add the language just for motion purposes.
Well, in the first paragraph, little I, it would be in line, page 2, line 11, after political party.
And you would add and promote support attacks?
Attacks or opposes a political party, because there we would be talking about either that party or a different political party.
Okay, so the amendment would then, the reg text, would, I'm referring now to page 2, line 10, political party committees. The public communication refers to a political party and promotes, supports, attacks, or opposes a political party, and is, and then continue on as is. Okay, and then with respect to little paragraph 2.
At line 18, after the word candidate, and we would have to say, and promotes, supports, attacks, or opposes that candidate or another candidate for the same office.
Okay, and so, Madam Secretary, the proposal would be on the agenda document, page 2, line 18. I'll start from line 17. The text would read, the public communication refers to a clearly identified House or Senate candidate and promotes, supports, attacks, or opposes that candidate or another candidate for that same office and is publicly distributed, and it would continue on as is. Okay, and then Commissioner Mason for little paragraph 3.
It would be just as described. As for the House and Senate candidates, but it would go in page 3, line 3, after the word candidate.
Okay, so same text inserted in little paragraph 3, which appears on page 3, line 3, after presidential candidate, as the proposal would insert with little paragraph 2. Okay. So essentially, okay. Is that, Madam Secretary, is that clear in terms of what the proposed amendment is? Okay. Would you like to so move, Commissioner?
I would.
Okay. Commissioner Mason so moves to make the following amendment to those regs text. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I very much appreciate what you're trying to do here. But then I've got that other principle about clarity, and I'm not sure that this does add clarity. In fact, I seem to recall that several of our commenters, one particularly resonates in my mind, said that if we were going to adopt a general PASO standard, then we'd better define it for them, because they really didn't know what it meant. And I recognize that we've already proposed to include PASO in a couple of places, and you know, I had some reservations about doing it even there, but I thought, well, if it's in those relatively circumscribed places, in the context of some fairly specific kinds of communications, I think they can figure out how to do it. To make it a general standard, I think, is going to be tough. I think it's going to be tough for the regulated community to comply with it unless we define the term for them, which I don't think we're in a position to do today. I think it's going to make them feel like they have to submit advisory opinion requests for all of their ad text before they run them, and I don't think that would be very good for the regulated community. I don't think it would be very good for us, and I'm afraid that it will embroil us in some of the same kinds of painful deliberations that we used to have over express advocacy, and we were, I think Congress was trying to get away from that when they went to, you know, a more time limit based standard, and we were trying to get away from that and going to a more time limit based standard. I think the rule as is a much more bright line standard, and I'm also not sure what the justification is for the time limits if you put in PASO. I think it's sort of the whole point of the time limits, I think, is that it operates as a proxy for when people are making electioneering-type communications. And adding in the PASO concept kind of undermines it and confuses the application. So I appreciate what you're trying to do, and I really am sympathetic to it. I'm just not convinced that it works in practice, unless we're prepared to define it. I mean, if we could come up with a definition that we all agreed on, that would be great. That, I'm sure, would be a service to the regulated community, but I'm not actually convinced that we could come up with a definition either here today or perhaps with more effort that all of us would be willing to support, or even four of us would be willing to support. And if that's the case, then we'd probably be better off not incorporating it into the general provisions of the rule.
Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub. Further discussion on Commissioner Mason's motion regarding PASO? Hearing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor say aye. Aye. All opposed?
No.
Motion fails by a vote of 3-3. Commissioners Toner, Mason, and Von Spakovsky voting affirmatively. The Vice Chairman, Commissioner Weintraub, and Walther voting no. Are there further proposed amendments with respect to the underlying rule at 109.21? Okay, then we have adopted a revised regulation in that regard, and we will work on an explanation and justification through our counsel. Clearly, we're not going to tackle that in the next couple of hours, but we will work diligently on that after the conclusion of this session. What I would propose to do is that we turn now to additional issues beyond the underlying rule, if that makes sense to my colleagues, and we begin a discussion on that and see just how far we can get on those issues, if it makes sense. And perhaps the first thing we could turn to is various proposals regarding time frames for common vendors and former employees and independent contractors. Commissioner Weintraub.
Mr. Chairman, can I make a suggestion? Because
yes.
There's another provision that is identical, I think, in both proposals, and that is the amendment to 109.21A1. So maybe we could do that quickly, since I don't think there's any dispute over that.
I think that's a great idea. That's the in whole or in part phraseology?
Yes.
Okay. Commissioner Weintraub, would you like to so move?
I would. I would like to move. I'm working off my document, but I think it's the language is exactly the same as in yours. I'd like to move the amendment set forth in agenda document 06-26, page 1, line 20, through page 2, line 3. And that is the amendment to 109.21A1.
Commissioner Weintraub has moved that we amend section 109.21A1 to insert the text in whole or in part on line 1 of page 2 of agenda document 0626. Discussion on Commissioner Weintraub's motion to insert in the phrase in whole or in part in that part of the regulations. I'll call the question. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes by a vote of 6-0, and the motion and the regulation is amended accordingly.
We're on a roll, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we're doing great. Then I propose that we then turn to a series of additional issues that were noticed in the NPRM, and perhaps we could start with a discussion of the appropriate time frame for the regulations governing common vendors, former employees, and independent contractors that appears at Section 109.21(d)(4). For common vendors and 109.21(d)(5) for former employees and independent contractors. The current regulation turns on a current election cycle in terms of the operative time frame for those rules. And agenda documents, I think, offer a couple of different approaches to that. I'll be real brief about what I'd be most comfortable with. Set out in agenda document 0625, it would reduce that time frame to 60 days. And would stand in law, draw upon a couple different sources for that. First of all, the commenters, we received a large number of comments from people who thought that that would be appropriate to reduce the time frame to 60 days. It also would be consistent, and we could sort of draw upon the longstanding regulation at 106.4G for polling data that basically treats polling data as worth only 5% of its initial value once 60 days have elapsed. I concede that there's a number of different demarcations that could be appropriate here in terms of this time frame. My big concern, though, is that an election cycle time frame, in my view, is overly broad, and I'd be much more comfortable if we made the regulation more narrowly tailored in terms of 60 days. But I am open to other types of cuts that would shorten the time frame for common vendors and former employees and independent contractors. So that's sort of my take on that. Mr. Vice Chairman.
I was going to suggest we take a brief recess. Worked really, last time.
You're really into recesses today.
Took us to 6-0 pretty quick.
Absolutely. If that'll get us to 6-0, we'll do a recess every 10 minutes. All right. We'll take a brief recess at the Vice Chairman's request.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Why don't we resume again? It's a resumption of open session regarding coordination. I really appreciate all the work that went into adoption of a revised rule for 109.21(c)(4) and the fact that we adopted it unanimously. I also want to reiterate the tremendous work that our staff did in getting us to this point with respect to the underlying rule, and also seeking, assembling, and making sense out of the data sets that we obtained from the outside. Alec Palmer and the entire IT team did an outstanding job. I also want to specifically thank Joe Stoltz and the entire audit group for their work on this project, and also the general counsel and his able lawyers in the Office of General Counsel. Maybe they're calling you, Mr. Vice Chairman, at this point, for the work that they did as well. It truly was a collaborative effort across division lines, and I think the agency was the better for it. So just want to thank everybody for that. Now we're going to turn to subsidiary issues with respect to the coordination rules, and we're going to start with proposals to amend or to add a safe harbor for endorsements. And the proposed text for that safe harbor is essentially the same in agenda document that I put out, as well as agenda document that the Vice Chairman put out. I think we'll work off of my agenda document 0625 at page 6. We have a proposed regs text for endorsements that appears as H. It would be a new section, H1. Safe harbor for endorsements, and it would read: a public communication in which a candidate for federal office endorses another candidate for federal or non-federal office does not satisfy the standards in paragraph C or D of this section with respect to the endorsing federal candidate, unless the public communication promotes, supports, attacks, or opposes the endorsing candidate or the endorsing candidate's opponent. End quote. That would be the regs text that would be inserted in that part of the regulations. And the upshot of this is to really make clear that federal candidates can make endorsements of federal and non-federal candidates, and they can be involved in the production of those endorsements, including advertising for them. Without that involvement, creating a coordinated communication. This was an issue that the Commission had to grapple with in a couple of advisory opinions. The general sense was that as long as there is no PASO for the endorsing candidate, that there was no evidence in the congressional record that Congress sought to restrict the ability of federal candidates to endorse other federal candidates or non-federal candidates, as long as no PASO for the endorsing candidate. So that would be the goal in the proposed regs text that is offered, and if somebody would like to so move that, we can have a discussion and a vote. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I would like to move the adoption of the text in Agenda Document 06-25 that begins on page 6, subsection H1, which you just described.
Vice Chairman has moved adoption of the regs text as set out in Agenda Document Number 0625, as appears on page 6, little 1, in that portion of page 6. Discussion on the Vice Chairman's motion to adopt. Commissioner Mason.
I wonder if the Chairman and Vice Chairman would consider it friendly. We had discussed this issue about the candidate's opponent and how it might apply or not apply in a primary situation, and I had suggested some alternate language that rather than saying or the endorsing candidate's opponent, we might say, or another candidate for the same office, to keep it on the candidate basis, number one, and to make it clear that in these periods where the primary hasn't been held, this would apply equally to any opponents in the primary, but also to any presumptive general election opponents.
So, Commissioner Mason, would you amend the text there so that the last part of the sentence would read, I'll just read it from the beginning of that line. Supports a tax or opposes, right now it reads, supports a tax or opposes the endorsing candidate or the endorsing candidate's opponent, and you would have it read, supports a tax or opposes the endorsing candidate or another candidate for the same office.
That's correct.
Okay. I think one thing. Commissioner Mason, would you view it as a friendly amendment that the text would read, and Madam Secretary, please let me know if this is not sufficiently clear. frankly, I wouldn't blame you if you told me that not much of this has been sufficiently clear. But anyway, the regs text would read, and I'm starting with from the next to the last line there for H1, supports a tax or opposes the endorsing candidate or another candidate for the same office as the endorsing candidate, end quote. Commissioner Weintraub.
You took the words right out of my mouth, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Ms. Lorenza and you are thinking similarly on this issue, so that is great. All right, discussion on Commissioner's the motion to adopt that regs text, H1. Hearing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries by a vote of 5-0. Commissioner Walther absent. All right, we will next take up a proposal regarding the use of publicly available information. And, Mr. Vice Chairman, we're going to work off of your document.
This is just so cooperative.
Solicitation?
Yeah. Okay.
Great language there.
Okay. Okay, but we'll go with your... Okay.
This version.
Okay. We'll next take up a proposal regarding endorsements, or excuse me, solicitations, which would appear as a new safe harbor at H2 of the regulations. And, Mr. Vice Chairman, I think we're going to work off of your agenda document for this provision.
Okay. I'm trying to minimize everyone's confusion as much as possible. On my agenda document, which is 06-26, I would propose amending subsection G2, which appears on page 8 of that document, to read a public communication in which a candidate for federal office solicits funds permitted by section 300.65 is not a coordinated communication with respect to the soliciting candidate if the public communication does not promote support, attack, or oppose the soliciting candidate, the soliciting candidate's opponents, or other, or another candidate who seeks election to the same office as the soliciting candidate.
Commissioner Mason,
I don't think you would need soliciting candidate's opponent, since the opponent would be another candidate,
okay.
Another candidate for the same office.
Well put. The spirit of compromise has generated a messy document.
Okay. So, Mr. Vice Chairman, let me just make sure we have the proposed regs text. This would be a new subsection. You style it as G2. It would appear as H2 in my document, but it's the same. We will place it in the reg book in that appropriate location, depending upon other things we may do yet later this afternoon. But the safe harbor for solicitations would read, and please, I'm going to make sure I get this exactly as you propose, a public communication in which a candidate for federal office solicits funds, as permitted by Section 300.65, is not a coordinated communication with respect to the soliciting candidate if the public communication does not promote, support, or attack or oppose the soliciting candidate, the soliciting candidate's opponent, or another.
I need my document back.
Oh, right, that would help.
I'm going blind on this.
Use the same construction. Okay, thank you. We'll give it another shot. The proposed regulation that the Vice Chairman is moving would read as follows for solicitations. A public communication in which a candidate for federal office solicits funds as permitted by Section 300.65 is not a coordinated communication with respect to the soliciting candidate if the public communication does not promote, support, attack, or oppose the soliciting candidate or another candidate who seeks election to the same office as the soliciting candidate, end quote. Discussion. Sure. Discussion on the proposal. Commissioner Mason.
We're going to come back to the solicitations for candidates and party committees in a moment.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
right.
That would be the plan.
If the Vice Chairman wants to discuss this, I'll be happy to defer to him, but essentially this was my request. And so
yes,
since
please.
Some members of the audience were completely mystified by the gap filling that I thought everybody understood. Let me say, in BCRA, there is this general ban on members and candidates raising money for something that could influence a federal election. But right in that same section in BCRA, in 441IE, is an exception allowing them to raise money for certain 501c organizations under various provisions. And the effect of our prior, or I guess I should say current solicitation reg, could have been read to say, well, despite the fact that BCRA tells you you can do these solicitations, if you do them in certain time periods, they're not permissible because they're coordinated. And so this is an effort to read the various provisions of BCRA together and to say that in those situations where Congress said that members could make solicitations, we're not going to stop them by characterizing them as coordinated communications, unless, of course, they promote the soliciting candidate.
I think I speak for everyone in saying that we're really going to be excited when this session is at a conclusion. As I understand it, the concept would be we would protect solicitations for another candidate for federal or non-federal office, as well as for state or national party committees, as well as for the entities permitted by Section 300.65. But that
the Vice Chairman's plan was to offer another amendment for candidates and party committees.
Another amendment. Okay.
This was council's suggestion to put the 300.65 provision
first
as a separate paragraph.
So okay. So it would be two separate paragraphs is what we're contemplating here. Okay.
I'm really worried about the audience now, Mr. Chairman. If you can't keep up.
Okay.
And I'm particularly worried about the council's office. They're going to have to implement all of this and put it all together for us.
Okay. Well, let me read it one last time, and then we'll tackle that. Okay. So the proposal would read as follows with respect to organizations outlined in 300.65. A public communication in which a candidate for federal office solicits funds for organizations as permitted by Section 300.65 is not a coordinated communication with respect to the soliciting candidate if the public communication does not promote, support, attack, or oppose a soliciting candidate or another candidate who seeks election to the same office as the soliciting candidate, end quote. Okay. Further discussion on that proposed regulation language. Hearing none, I will mercifully call the question. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries by a vote of 5-0 with Commissioner Walther president. Okay, Mr. Vice Chairman or Commissioner Mason, will there now be a motion with respect to the other entities?
I defer to Commissioner Mason.
Commissioner Mason, you're recognized.
Mr. Weintraub wants to offer the motion. I'd be happy to.
No, it's just that I think I've got it.
Fine. I will defer.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of another amendment that I guess it would be either G or H3 at this point, whichever paragraph number it comes out to be. But the text would be drawn from our agenda document, which is 06-26, page 8. Lines 8 to 14 with the following amendments, because it didn't come out quite right. On lines 9 and 10, we would delete the words state or national and just leave it at political party committee, because we didn't want to exclude district and local committees. So that was just a drafting error. And on line 11, 13, and 14, the word endorsing should be replaced with the word soliciting. Yes. One more on line 12. Endorsing replaced by soliciting.
So the proposed regulation would read: a public communication in which a candidate for federal office solicits funds for another candidate for federal or non-federal office or a political party committee is not a coordinated communication with respect to the soliciting candidate if the public communication does not promote, support, attack, or oppose the soliciting candidate or another candidate who seeks election to the same office as the soliciting candidate, end quote, to parallel the earlier provision. Is that
beautiful?
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub. So that would encompass solicitations for federal or non-federal candidates, as well as party committees, whether they be national, state, or local party committees, but would not encompass PACs and other types of entities. Obviously, we're covering the entities described by 300.65 in the earlier provision we adopted. Is that the
framework? That's it.
Okay. Discussion on Commissioner Weintraub's proposed amendment. Commissioner von Spakovsky.
I'm just wondering why you don't want to include PACs in this. We're basically giving them the right to endorse everybody with one exception.
Yeah.
I don't want to confuse the matter, but I just suddenly noticed that we've included just about everybody, but not PACs. And I'm wondering, is there a policy or a regulatory reason why we're not including that? I mean,
let me ask a more particular question, if I might.
Sure, Mason.
We have, you know, the phenomenon of leadership PACs, which we've actually formally recognized in various ways now. And so what would the effect of this be on a member who sends out a solicitation for his leadership PAC during the covered period and assume it doesn't promote support attack or pose, or, you know, that candidate or that candidate's opponent, but rather it's just a straightforward effort to raise money for the Searchlight PAC or the Majority Leaders Fund or whatever the case might be?
Discussion on that issue in terms of political action committees.
As you know, Commissioner Mason, I didn't vote for that particular regulation on the leadership PACs. I never liked those leadership PACs anyway.
I guess my thought is I'm not entirely sure what all the implications of adding PACs to this are. I mean, I have a general sense of how these things present themselves with candidates and parties. And I'm thinking back a little bit to the testimony we had and the comments we got, trying to think of circumstances in which this kind of activity was going on with PACs, and you know, given the breadth of it as a safe harbor, I'm not sure the implications of it.
Well, the reason I mentioned that was, of course, because we had, as you know, the executive director of Emily's List, who came and testified and, in fact, showed us a video. And the video was one of these videos consisting of individual women talking about Emily's List and why they should, you know, contribute money to it, and it included some incumbent candidates. In fact, I believe Senator Clinton was one of the people there, and so we had testimony from that particular PAC, I believe, saying that there really should be an exemption for those kind of endorsements.
I actually think,
Commissioner Weintraub.
Sorry, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually think that video did not involve solicitations for funds. It involved soliciting candidates. They were trying to encourage women to run for office. I think that was the point of that video. I don't think there was any fundraising at all involved in that.
I stand corrected. But I guess I don't see the difference between the two. You know, we're saying it's okay for them to solicit candidates, but not okay to solicit money for them. I realize we're very close here on a rule. I just don't quite understand the rationale for accepting them out of this general exemption we have for endorsements being given by a federal candidate.
Commissioner Weintraub, please.
I hear what you're saying, but I guess what we were trying to do here is address a specific problem that was presented to us. And I think it was presented to us most clearly in the context of federal office holders who wanted to help out, help to build the farm team, help to raise funds for non-federal office candidates. And again, it's a safe harbor. So we don't we don't have to give them a safe harbor at all, but the point here, I think, was that we recognize that this is a valid concern that federal office holders would want to help out non-federal candidates and perhaps other federal candidates, and we're aware of them doing them for party committees as well. But, you know, the further you get away from that, I think we were trying to carve this out as a more narrow exception to address the problem that was specifically presented to us.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
I guess the other advantage to it is that it is, it's presented before us now. It reasonably closely tracks 441I E subset 3 for the those of you who've got urgent N2, who've got your reg book in front of you, but the statute book in front of you, and there's, and so, I mean, to the degree that's sort of consistent with the statutory structure, there's, you know, it has that value to it.
For my part, I would be comfortable extending the safe harbor to PACs for the reasons outlined here, but I mean, I think that even if we don't, the proposed safe harbor would provide broader protections than exist under current law, and would make clear that these candidates can solicit funds for party committees, state, federal, national, as well as state and federal, or state and or non-federal and federal candidates, and I think that is an improvement under the existing law. So I'm comfortable. I'd be very comfortable extending it to PACs as well, but I do think that even without that, this would be a positive addition to the regulations. Commissioner Mason.
I appreciate the Vice Chairman's reference to 441 IE, but it's, you know, that I have a similar take on that as I did to the 501C solicitations. 441 IE prohibits solicitations in connection with elections to federal office or to non-federal office. It limits them either way to funds consistent with the FECA. And so it seems to me there's a clear implication that in a variety of ways members are going to be soliciting funds. And, you know, if a reference to that section, in essence, the limitations implied in that section helps bound this, I think that would be fine and appropriate, because I'm not certainly intending anything other than what BCRA specifically intended. I don't see any difference there in a member soliciting funds for PACs, and I mentioned the leadership PACs because it's obvious, and we'll get an advisory opinion request if we if we don't do something in that regard, either from a leadership PAC or from Mr. Bauer on behalf of Emily's list. So if referring back and somehow bounding it with the limitations of Section 441 IE makes it more comfortable, I'd be happy to go that way.
Vice Chairman.
Thanks. I'm struggling here because I'm not entirely sure I understand the implications fully of adding PACs to the list as well. It may well be appropriate, just sort of with the question presented as it is right now. I'm not confident entirely that I'm entirely comfortable with the implications of that.
Okay, further discussion on Commissioner Weintraub's amendment to the regulations text for solicitations in this area. I'll call the Commissioner Mason.
I'm puzzled as to what we're going to do, because we're going to get the question. I don't want to create a negative legislative history, as it were, by offering an amendment and losing, because perhaps in this one area, since we're going to have to come back with an ENJ, would my colleagues be willing to leave this open and at least consider it when we come back? Because I can understand not wanting to be rushed into this at 3:30 on a Friday afternoon, and if we can get everything put to bed, I'd like to do that. But I honestly believe that we would be making a mistake if we adopted a provision that didn't somehow account for an ability for members to make solicitations that they're otherwise permitted to make.
And I should note that clearly whenever this session ends, we will be authorizing counsel to work with us on an explanation and justification. That will then be reviewed to all commissioners for their vote, and there will be a chance to take, during that process, a collective look at all the issues. And I think Commissioner Mason makes a good point. We could take an additional look at this one issue and see how we may come out on that. And I'm comfortable doing that, and that process will unfold. So are we comfortable? Why don't we call the question on this motion with the regs language as is, but with the caveat that we will continue to be, as we work on the explanation, justification, work through all these issues, there will be a vehicle for further analysis of these provisions. Okay, all those in favor of Commissioner Weintraub's motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries by a vote of 5-0 with Commissioner Walther absent, and the regulation is adopted. Okay, that handles the solicitation portion of our work. Next, we have a proposal regarding a proposed safe harbor for use of publicly available information, and I believe we're going to work off of the Vice Chairman's document in that regard. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you. If you turn to page 3 of 06-26, there is at the very bottom, beginning on line 21, there is some existing language and some new language which addresses the section 109.21D. In this case, it's D3, although I think my motion is going to encompass both D2 and D3. And this deals with the question of whether coordination has occurred, whether the conduct prong has been met to the degree that their a candidate or their committee has either material involvement or substantial discussions with an outside entity around an advertisement, but the outside entity relies on publicly available information in the production, creation, and distribution of the communication. I would like to propose adding a sentence at the end of both subsection D2 and D3 that states that a communication does not satisfy this paragraph if the information material to the creation, production, or distribution of the communication was obtained from a publicly available source.
The Vice Chairman has moved to insert new language into current section D3 regarding substantial discussion. The following language at the end of that paragraph: a communication does not satisfy this paragraph if the information material to the creation, production, or distribution of the communication was obtained from a publicly available source, end quote, and to insert the same language into paragraph D4 with regard to, D2,
I think.
D2 regarding material involvement. discussion on the vice chairman's proposed amendment. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
I just have a question. I apologize if I'm confused. Mr. Vice Chairman, you're not talking about your agenda document. You're talking about the actual regulation in the book, which
I apologize. My agenda document includes the text of D3, both the text that is currently in the reg and also adds at the very end of it a new section. The section that I read was only the new language which would be inserted. I'm not sure whether that was clear.
Into D3, but you're also into D2, which is not included in the agenda document.
Correct. Okay. Correct. I'm seeking to accommodate the interests of others in adding it to D2.
Okay, the Vice Chairman has moved to insert that language into the existing regulations at Part D3 for the substantial discussion prong and D2 for the material involvement prong. Further discussion on the Vice Chairman's proposed motion. Hearing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries by a vote of 5-0 with Commissioner Walther absent, and the regulation is adopted. Okay, then our next item of business concerns proposed provisions regarding firewalls. And, Mr. Vice Chairman, I think we're going to start with your document as a baseline for that. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to, beginning with document 06-26, on page 8, line 25, which in the version I submitted is subsection would create a subsection H. It's not clear to me at this point in the day whether that would be the appropriate letter for it to bear, but this would permit the commercial vendors, former employees, and I would like to add the words political committee, what I'd like to do with this text is on line 17, where it says employer political party committee, delete the word party so that it would encompass political committees generally. And essentially what this provision would do would be to permit them to create a system of firewalls and would provide them some regulatory protection to the degree that they did and the firewalls were in place and operated. Effectively.
And would you like to so move, Mr. Vice Chairman?
I'm sorry, I apologize. Yes, I would like to move that.
The Vice Chairman has moved the adoption of a safe harbor for the establishment and use of firewalls, which would read as follows. Quote, the conduct standards in paragraph D of this section are not met if the commercial vendor, former employee, or political committee has established and implemented a firewall that meets the following requirements. This safe harbor provision does not apply if specific information indicates that despite the firewall, information about the candidates or political party, or political committees, campaign plans, projects, activities, or needs that is material to the creation, production, or distribution of the communication was used by or conveyed to the person paying for the communication. End quote. That would be the preamble, and then the regs text on page 9, lines 1 through 10 as well. Do we need to do any conforming amendments to lines 1 through 10 on page 9?
Not that I'm aware of. Oh, I'm sorry, yes, on line 7 we would delete the word party.
What
I'm sorry. Yeah, we wouldn't delete party on line 7 because it's referring to the political parties of the candidates or their opponents. My mistake.
Okay, so the regs text that appears on page 9 of the vice chairman's document from lines 1 through 10 would be as is. And the regs text that appears on the vice chairman's document, page 8, lines 15 through 23, would be as is, except that on line 17, where it says political party committee, it would say political committee. And lines 20, where it says political party committee, it would say political committee.
Yes.
Okay, discussion on the vice chairman's motion regarding a proposed safe harbor for the use of firewalls.
Mr. Chairman?
Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
I may have missed this when we were discussing it, but we're including in this motion the second part of this provision, H2, in other words, lines 8 through 10 on page 9.
Yes, we would. And basically that text would be exactly as it appears on page 9.
Thank you.
Yes. Would you like
to just indicate it, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Vice Chairman, yes.
Yeah, I made a mistake as I was. I think this was my doing. On line 20, the word "party" would remain in because, again, that's referring not to the entity that's creating the firewall, but the candidate or the political party committee's campaign plan. So it would be the party's plans, not in that case. So the line 20 would remain as it is originally and appears in agenda document 06-26.
Vice Chairman has moved approval of new regs language as appears at agenda document 06-26 from page 8, lines 15 through page 9, line 10, with the one exception, page 8, line 17, where it says political party committee, that will read political committee. Mr. Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question about page 9, lines 8 to 10. Says the firewall must be described in a written policy that is distributed at the time it is implemented to all relevant employees, consultants, and clients affected by that policy. Of course, if employees who are involved in working for the company aren't there at the time that it's implemented, it wouldn't make any sense. In other words, you have the whatever employees are there at the time it's implemented are there, and then other employees who may be relevant employees could come at some later time. We had proposed alternatively to the language that's there, saying the firewall must be described in a written policy that is distributed by the trying to parallel this distributed to all relevant employees and consultants and implemented before contracting with or being employed by the person paying for the communication. I don't know if that represents an improvement to the vice chairman, but I think I think that language as it is potentially problematic.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman.
Yeah, I guess I'd like to. The reason why I had stepped away from the contracted the point of the contract as the point of the distribution was once the circumstances where the contracts already exist, right, and it seemed that some of these entities have ongoing relationships, and to the degree that the coordination becomes a problem, either because the vendor or outside group suddenly wants to begin a contractual relationship with a candidate party or whatever, the requirement that the firewall had been in place prior to the point of contract, the contract being signed, didn't entirely make sense. The problem you seem to be raising seemed somewhat difference, which was, as I understood it, the question of the distribution of the policy to subsequently hired employees, which I'm not sure is resolved by having the distribution at the time of the contracting.
What if it were distribution were required before the point that any work was performed pursuant to the contract?
Commissioner Weintraub.
I think you're still not solving your problem, because what if somebody then comes on board after the work has started? I think maybe we need some language that would say, that would add on and is something along the lines of and is subsequently distributed to any later employees, consultants, I guess it would be employees and consultants who are affected by the policy. Is that the problem that you're trying to get at?
And if I might, one possibility we might say is we cut the language that says at the time it is implemented, and the E&J would clearly identify these issues, but we could say the firewall must be described in a written policy that is distributed to all relevant employees, consultants, and clients affected by the policy. And then the E&J would make clear that we apply that based on when the work is being performed and making sure that it's in the hands of the relevant people. So that could be one approach, that we just delete the language at the time it is implemented and just say that it must be described in written policy as distributed to all relevant employees, consultants, and clients affected by the policy. Mr. Vice Chairman.
I mean, I think that may make sense. I mean, I think the important point, I think, with us choosing all of these different phraseologies is that the policy must be in place prior to the passage of information back and forth, prior to the issue coming up, and that we would not be wanting to permit people to take advantage of the safe harbor to the degree that they tried to implement firewall policies after information began flowing. And so I think that we all sort of have a common goal in that respect. And it's possible that can be articulated clearly in an ENJ.
Commissioner Vontkowski and then Commissioner Weintraub. Commissioner.
Well, the thing I was going to suggest is, does this satisfy the situation, which is if you take the language the chairman has just proposed, deleting at the time it's implemented, but adding at the end and is in place at the time the coordinated communication is made? So in other words, it would read, the firewall must be described in a written policy that is distributed to all relevant employees, consultants, and clients affected by the policy and is in place at the time the coordinated communication is made. Does that resolve your concern?
Would one challenge be that if the safe harbor applied, there wouldn't be a coordinated communication? Because it would, if you're in the safe harbor, you're outside the conduct prongs.
Okay, so you leave out the word coordinated, so it just says at the time the communication is made.
Commissioner Weintraub, you had sought recognition.
Yeah, I'm just not sure that that solves the problem. It's not that I have any problem with the language, it's that I'm not sure it solves the problem. And then you have the communication out there, and it's an undefined, what communication are we talking about? Personally, would be fine with deleting the language and explaining it in the E&J. I'll toss out one other suggestion, which is, would it help if, instead of at the time it is implemented, we use the word contemporaneously? Does that do it?
Mr. Norton.
Yeah, we were talking along the same lines. On a timely basis, it would also, of course, require explanation. But the idea
means
is, it's handed to the people before they actually act pursuant to the contract. So in other words, instead of at the time it is implemented, another suggestion would be to say on a timely basis.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Does that open up the door to somebody say, well, it was, within a week of when we started the work, so that was pretty timely. I'm worried that on a timely basis might be ambiguous, and even if we put in an explanation, that we might be better off not having the phrase in the regulation, because that opens up the argument that, well, I was timely enough, I was sort of timely, I was pretty close to the beginning of the...
You're giving heart to all the enforcement lawyers downstairs, Commissioner.
It's not my goal.
another idea. because I, you know, clearly within the reg turns on services provided by the contractors, is we could say at the end of the sentence, it could read, the firewall must be described in a written policy that is distributed to all relevant employees, consultants, and clients affected by the policy prior to any services being rendered.
Perhaps even at the beginning of the clause, prior to any services being rendered.
I'm sorry, Mr. Deutsch.
Perhaps to put that at the beginning of the clause.
And where would
Under number two, prior to any services being rendered, the firewall must be described in a written policy that is distributed to all relevant employees. And we explain in the E and J that
what that means.
If an employee came later, of course, it would mean services with respect to that employee's work.
Discussion on that concept.
Sounds good.
I'll buy that.
Yeah, I mean, it leaves the question, or the we would need to be clear that to the degree that a vendor and the person paying for it had a ongoing relationship that didn't involve work on activities that would be covered by these regulations, and then decided to take on additional work that would be covered. The fact that services were already being rendered didn't make them unable to establish a firewall. So that would be the one. I mean, because it raises the same problem I have with tying it to the date of the contract. And I think of a situation like polling services, where you may contract with a polling company to poll for things unrelated to federal elections or elections of any sort. And yet, as time goes by, you may choose to have them do polls on that issue. And suddenly the firewalls and the coordination has become a concern for you. You've already got an ongoing relationship. They're already providing services to you. But for the first time in your economic relationship with them, the questions of the coordination rules become, at issue. And again, I guess the fact that we're describing it as services being rendered, one can interpret that to mean the services that would be covered by the Act. And it would be in some ways easier to handle in that sort of, it would be, this language would be preferable in that sense. But I do think that we should just be clear that there are situations where entities are employing service providers in this area for activities unrelated to federal elections, and then the work changes. Media companies do the same thing. Many people cutting ads for an entity that may be unrelated to elections, and then do their election work.
I do think that these issues could be fleshed out in E and J, and I would be comfortable if the provision read, the firewall must be described in a written policy that is distributed to all relevant employees, consultants, and clients affected by the policy. And then we scope it. I'm comfortable with that. Mr. Vice Chairman, would you be comfortable?
I am too.
Okay. And then we tackle these issues in E and J. Okay, so the proposed regs text offered by the Vice Chairman, page 9, lines 8 through 10, will read, quote, the firewall must be described in a written policy that is distributed to all relevant employees, consultants, and clients affected by that policy, end quote. Further discussion on the Vice Chairman's motion regarding a safe harbor for firewalls. Hearing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes by a vote of 5-0 with Commissioner Walther absent. Okay, our next item on our agenda is proposed amendments to the time frame for common vendors, former employees, and independent contractors at 109.21D4 and 109.21D5. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, if I could continue my role as the soul that asks for the breaks, if we could just have a couple of moments to make sure we know what our language is, I would appreciate a short recess.
We'll take a 5-minute recess.
Thanks.
Okay, why don't we resume? We are considering possible amendments to the time frame for former employees or independent contractors, as well as common vendors. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to move the introduction of text which appears in Agenda Document 06-26, beginning at page 4, line 13, and continuing on to page 7, lines 22, with two substantive changes. The first substantive change being on page 5, line 22, deleting the words "in the current 2-year election cycle" and inserting the words "during the previous 120 days." And the second substantive change would occur on page 6, line 21, where the words, the previous two-year election cycle would be deleted, and the words, the previous 120 days, inserted.
And you're so moving, Mr. Vice Chairman?
Yes, I am.
The Vice Chairman has moved to insert new regs language as set out in agenda document number 06-26, beginning on page 6, excuse me, on page 4, line 13, through page 7, line 22. And the most pertinent of those changes would replace page 6, line 21. The current text reads, current two-year election cycle with previous 120 days. And likewise, on page 5, line 2, the reg text that currently reads, in the current two-year election cycle will be replaced with during the previous 120 days. Discussion on the Vice Chairman's motion. Commissioner Mason.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm supportive. This reflects the very rapid decay rate of the utility of inside information from campaigns, and it's something we raised in the NPRM. I had initially suggested that we use our polling regulation, which treats a poll as worth only 5% of its initial value after 60 days. And I had suggested to one of my colleagues as an alternative that we count any ads so produced as an in-kind contribution, but value it on only 5% of the cost. It wouldn't be quite as neat a way to to deal with the situation. But I think there's some symmetry to using the 120-day time frame that we use for other purposes in this rule here, and it fits still within that polling context. And indeed, in just looking at the polling regulation, after 180 days, the value of the poll is zero. And so I suppose after 120 days, we're somewhere between 0 and 5%, which ought to meet those substantiality tests.
We're very fond of being in the 90s. And that would be about 95%. Discussion on the Vice Chairman's motion. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just say that initially I was supportive of a longer window. I think when you look at the Senate contest, a six-year election cycle is on its face unreasonable. I was comfortable with at least cutting it back to a two-year election cycle. But I think in the spirit of cooperation that has perhaps surprisingly pervaded this afternoon, I will agree to the amendment.
Thank you. And I am very much in the same vein. I thought there was a strong basis for reducing the time frame to 60 days. Again, as Commissioner Mason outlined, we do have some regulations that suggest that the value of information after 60 days is quite low, perhaps as low as 5%. But I think 120 days is a very solid demarcation as well. So I'm comfortable supporting the motion. Further discussion on the Vice Chairman's motion? I'll call the question. All those in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? Vice Chairman's motion passes by a vote of 5-0, with Commissioner Walther absent. Okay. Further issues. Mr. Vice Chairman, are there further issues on your end?
There are not.
Okay. And I know we have some proposed technical corrections. Do we want to talk about that? Commissioner Von Spakovsky, do you want to talk briefly?
I certainly don't want to prolong this, since I understand the air conditioning has been turned off, but because they're working on it. Most of the technical changes that I had suggested earlier the OGC had adopted, they were simply to try to get rid of some of the repetitive language in the regulation. It's frankly complex enough without doing that. An easy one, I think, we could take care of is we constantly refer throughout the reg to a candidate's authorized committee or political party committee and an agent thereof. And I think if we simply in 109.20A, where we talk about what coordinated means, if we simply add a line at the end of that sentence that says, for purposes of this subpart, a candidate's authorized committee or political party committee shall include an agent thereof. And then we don't have to repeat that throughout all these different regs that we have adopted today. So I would make that suggestion, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Discussion on that proposal. Mr. Vice Chairman.
I guess my sense is that, you know, to the degree that the words don't add anything, it would be fine to have fewer of them, and so I would be supportive of that.
So, Commissioner Von Spakovsky, you want to move new language for that area?
I will move that new language, and do I need to give that again to our secretary?
As I understand it, Commissioner Von Spakovsky, you're moving to amend Section 109.20A so that it reads as follows. Coordinated means in cooperation, consultation, or concert with, or at the request or suggestion of, a candidate, a candidate's authorized committee, or a political party committee, period. For purposes of this subpart, a candidate, candidate's authorized committee, or political party committee shall include an agent thereof, end quote.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion on Commissioner Von Spakovsky's motion. Commissioner Weintraub.
And can we leave it at that and then just leave it to council to go through and take out or any agent thereof at every place that it appears?
I think we will definitely be authorizing council to be doing conforming and technical amendments and working with us, of course, on the explanation and justification. So, yes. Mr. Vice Chairman.
And if I could add, I believe Agenda Document 06-25 does that throughout it, and so that's a helpful guide.
Further discussion on Commissioner Von Spakovsky's motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion passes by a vote of 5-0. One final issue, and I'm not going to offer this unless there's support for it, consistent with this spirit of cooperation that has been with us this afternoon. But there is a proposal that is set out on page 3 of the agenda document that I published. At the top of the page, it would be a new paragraph 5 that would say a communication that can be received nationwide is not directed to the jurisdiction where any clearly identified House or Senate candidate is on the ballot, end quote. And basically the goal of this would be to make clear that for House and Senate campaigns, if someone is airing a nationwide ad, it's not that advertisement, given that it's running all over the country, is not being targeted or is not being directed to any one particular state or congressional district. The NPRM had sought comment on this concept, and there was some support for it. There was also a parallel proposal that would try to define numerically what directed to means in our current regulation in terms of the number of people within a jurisdiction, because right now we don't define what directed to means. This is sort of another way at it, another cut at it, to say that nationwide advertising would not be viewed as directed to the relevant electorate of a House or Senate candidate. It would be viewed as directed to the electorate of a presidential candidate, given that presidential candidates are running nationwide. Again, I'll offer this, but only if people are comfortable with it. If they're not, they're not. Vice Chairman has informed me that, quote, he doesn't want to do it.
You know, if I'd wanted to be captured in the record phrasing it quite that way, I think I would have spoken into the microphone.
Well, it was very concise. I got your point. Commissioner Weintraub, do you not want to do it either?
I also don't want to do it, but I'll even offer for the record a substantive reason why I don't want to do it. although I would have been happy with the just moving on approach also. The problem with this, as I see it, is that one could, in any given year, you can identify, you know, half a dozen hot races. And one could craft an ad that you run across the country, and if the balance of power in the House or the Senate depended on this, it would be worth it to somebody to run an ad across the country that promoted half a dozen candidates. And those, you know, it would clearly run in their jurisdictions, and it would run across the country also, and they'd just be willing to eat the expense of running it in the other districts, because, or the other states, more likely, because if the outcome was that they got control of the Senate or the House at the end of the day, I think people might think that was well worth the extra expenditure. So I think that this could open up. I understand that's not what you're going for, but I think that it could open up a potential for an abusive situation. So that's why I won't vote for it. But I appreciate the effort.
Well, we certainly wouldn't want to do that. And in that spirit, I won't offer it. Other proposed amendments or issues, Mr. General Counsel, from your perspective, other things that we need to focus on?
No, Mr. Chairman, there are none.
Okay. Do any of my colleagues have any other issues? Okay. What we will do is we will work with our council on perfecting an explanation and justification for the new regulations that have been adopted today, and then we will proceed from there. This concludes the final rulemaking as required by the Shays litigation. I want to thank everybody at the Federal Election Commission, all staff in all of the divisions, all of my colleagues. It's been an extraordinary process, and it is, I think I speak for everyone in saying how wonderful it is to be near the end of it. We do have an explanation and justification to work with, but we have completed our obligations under the Shays 1 litigation. I think that's a very good accomplishment for the agency. And Mr. Vice Chairman, I also want to personally thank you for everything you've done since you joined the agency, and also Commissioner Weintraub, my colleague on the Regulations Committee, for this difficult process. It's been a pleasure working with you through these issues. Commissioner Weintraub?
Mr. Chairman, I want to return the compliment. It's been a pleasure working with you and everyone as well. And I also want to particularly express my thanks to the staff who worked untold hours on all of these regulations. And we'll get no recognition in the press as a result of it. But they really have worked very hard, and I appreciate it, as I know all the commissioners do.
Okay, that concludes then our deliberations over coordinated communications. Mr. Koster, any administrative matters to bring to our attention?
No, Mr. Chairman.
With that, this meeting is adjourned.